cold winters. We are continuing for this session some passages of the Haggadah, and in particular with an emphasis on Rav Kook's explanations of the Haggadah, but not only Rav Kook. Essentially, the text we're using are texts that are taken directly from the Babylonian Talmud, but as you already know, back into the 16th century, the Haggadic texts of the Talmud were put into a separate compilation that is called the Ein Yaakov, the Fountain of Jacob, simply because the compiler, who also wrote commentaries, was Yaakov ibn Chaviv, one of the Chachamim of Yerushalayim, and Ein Yaakov became a very, very popular compendium. There are a few translations in English and the like, but, you know, Ein Yaakov, there's even a Yiddish expression. I know we talked about this. When you had a simple Jew who was not capable of the involved halachic analyses of the Gemara, he was called an Ein Yaakov Yid. Sometimes that was said in an affectionate way. Sometimes it was said in a condescending way. But on the other hand, that is both unfair to the Yid and unfair to the book. Because in point of fact, although Ein Yaakov can be understood on all sorts of levels, stories and the like, but in fact, there is infinite depth to the words of Haggadah. And indeed, the reason Rav Kook, among many others, wrote commentaries on the Haggadah is because he saw in Haggadah a key to the spirit and the neshama of the Jewish people and of our relationship to God. Halacha can be described as the body, the guf. And again, some of this we've covered. I'm just setting it out as a new orientation for people who may have come. Halacha tells me how to behave. What I do with my body, keep the Shabbat, keep kosher, daven, wear tefillin, etc. But Haggadah is the neshama. What should I think? What should I feel? What does it mean to be a Jew? Because far too often, we live a life where the trees obscure the overall forest. Now, rightfully so, a halachically committed Jew is very focused on detail. You know, the Zman of Shema will end at 9 o'clock. So if I do it 9:01, too late, etc. I have to look at the clock, etc. But in the course of being so obsessed, and rightfully so, with the details of halachic observance, we sometimes lose sight of the broader picture of what type of people does God want us to be? What are the values of Judaism? What are the ethics and morals that are implicit in the halachic system? And that is where Haggadah comes in. So yes, Haggadah uses parable, it uses hyperbole, it uses exaggeration. And remember, we had this whole big discussion, is all Haggadah true or not true? Some people say it's Baba Mises, it's stories. But the Maral says, and Rav Kook follows the Maral, that this is a false dichotomy. Because you ask the question, is it true or is it not true? Haggadah is absolutely true, but not always in the literal sense. Truth exists on many, many levels. Chazal sought to convey spiritual ideas by hyperbole, by exaggeration, even by folktale. But that doesn't mean it's not true. It means the truth is being expressed through a particular medium. So the whole dichotomy, is it true or not true? Maral says is a false question. Because truth can be conveyed in many, many ways. There is the truth of the heart and the truth of the soul and the truth of the mind. There is the truth of historical factoids. And then there is the truth of ultimate spiritual truths that can be conveyed in many, many ways. This, to be a little controversial, this is why even a term like myth is not a derogatory term. A myth is, we use myth colloquially today, just means it's something not true. But that is not the technical use of myth. The technical use of myth, as an anthropologist uses the word myth, is it is a vehicle for the conveyance of deep spiritual truths. Okay, so that's very important. So in many, many ways, although the story we're going to read today actually is quite literal, it probably is an actual historical story, so in a way I'm making a more general point that's not even going to apply to our text. But as a general rule, I think it's important to understand that Haggadah does not have to be measured against the standards of historical probability or rationality, because it is a symbolic language. And the great commentators, like Maral in particular, Maral was perhaps the greatest of the Haggadah commentators, and in more modern vein, Rav Kook, who is really kind of a successor to the Maharal in this endeavor, their job is to open up the symbols so we can feel the spiritual truth and power that is there. So seen in this way, the notion of being an Ein Yaakov Yid, all I can say is, halavai v'halavai, we should all be Ein Yaakov Yidden, because that is really the key to what it means to be Jewish. And Chazal, in fact, even to be human to some degree. And Chazal identified this a long time ago. There's a statement in Chazal that says, Ritzoncha leida mi sha'amar v'haya ha'olam. If it is your desire to know the Creator in an intimate way, tilmod Agadah, you should learn the Agadah, because that will give you a sense of being connected to the Almighty. So that's why I say that the various skeptics that say, oh, Agadah, true, not true, again, Maharal really basically tells us that that's almost an irrelevant issue. Because, of course, it's true, but it doesn't have to be literally true, etc. And in a way, you could even extrapolate that to what you might call post-rabbinic Agadah, for example, Hasidic stories, you know, which are not Agadah in the strict sense, because they are not the words of Chazal. You know, stories may be true, may be not true, it's almost not important, but they convey certain teachings, and they are vehicles for teachings. You may recall Rav Nachman of Breslov, for example, was a great, great Hasidic Rebbe, who taught in many, many ways. He taught by direct Torah teachings as well, Likutei Maharan, but one of his most powerful vehicles was simply telling stories. And he doesn't give you the meaning of the story, so it's very enigmatic, and people still, Breslovers and other people who study them, still talk about the meaning of the stories. And somebody once asked Rav Nachman why he communicated by stories. And Rav Nachman said, well, with a story you can't lose. If I tell somebody a Dvar Torah, you know, they either get it or they don't get it. You know, if they don't get it, it's just kind of a waste of time. I tell them a story. If they get the inner meaning, that's wonderful. And if they don't, they at least have a good story. So he says, stories you can never lose, because no matter what level it's understood, there is something that, you know, you walk away with. And once again, so even there, you know, the stories are not always true, but nevertheless, they teach spiritual teachings. In fact, just one other story about stories. This is a famous literature. I have to give equal time to Litvak and Hasidim. So now I have to tell you a story with the Chafetz Chaim. That once one of his students in Radin was arrested and was accused of smuggling, which in Tsarist Russia was a very serious offense. Could be a death penalty or 20 years in Siberia. Very, very difficult. So the Chafetz Chaim came as a character witness to testify that the student was a good student who was not involved in criminal activity. And he didn't know Russian, so there had to be an interpreter. And under the court procedure, every witness had to swear on a Christian Bible. Christian Bible, not like today, you know, any Bible or whatever it is. It had to be a Christian Bible. So the Chafetz Chaim refused to do that, of course. So the judge said, we can't accept you as a witness. So the attorney, the defense attorney for the student, said to the judge, Judge, this rabbi is a person who is so trustworthy, so honest, he is so uncorruptible, that you ought to excuse him from taking an oath. And I'll tell you a story, how he doesn't care about money, he can't be bribed. That one time he was walking in the street, and somebody pickpocketed him. There was a pickpocket. And the pickpocket took whatever money the Chafetz Chaim has and was running away. And this rabbi was running after the pickpocket, saying, I'm mochel you, I forgive you, because he didn't want the pickpocket to be guilty of the sin of theft. And the Chafetz Chaim couldn't catch him, so he just said, I forgive you, I forgive you. So he said to the judge, such a man doesn't care about money. Obviously, he's not corruptible. So the judge looks at the attorney and says, do you expect me to believe that story? It is so ridiculous. So the attorney says, to be honest, Your Honor, I don't believe it either. But the one thing I know is they don't tell those stories about me or you. So even if a story is not true, but the fact that it's told means that it has a direct relevance to the personality and the midos. People say this about the Maharal. Did the Maharal make a golem? You know, the artificial man that the Maharal is said to have made. So as I say, there's a whole big story about that, because the Maharal died, you know, in the 16th century. And the first time we hear about the golem is in a chronicle of the 19th century. So for over 300 years, nobody knew about this golem. But so did the Maharal make it or not? People say it's in the attic of the synagogue in Prague that's locked up and nobody can go into it. You know, people say all sorts of stories about it. But, you know, the answer would be, we don't know if the Maharal made the golem, but once again, if such a story is told, we have to believe that he had the power to do it if he so wanted. Maybe he wanted, maybe he didn't. Okay. So what we're going to look at today, though, is interesting. We're going to look at a fairly long story, and the story itself is not so difficult to follow, so it's not as intricate as other Haggadic passages. And as far as we know, this story is actual history. This is not symbolic. It has many symbolic meanings, but it's an actual historical narrative. And it involves a halachic debate, but it quickly turns nasty, so to speak, almost a palace revolt. And if you are so inclined, you can look at this as a revolutionary story about halachic power being seized by the people. But we'll see that perhaps we shouldn't go that far. And it starts off, I'm not going to read every line, but I'm going to go over try every part of the story. It starts off with Tana Rabbanan, a teaching of the rabbis, and the particular debate, let's get the particular debate, is whether the Amida of Arvit, the Amida of Ma'ariv, the Shemon Esrei of Ma'ariv, is an obligation or optional. Again, we talked about some of this, just to give you a quick background again. We know, of course, that one is supposed to pray three times a day, Shachris, Mincha, Ma'ariv. We know that unequivocally, Shachris and Mincha are obligations. But there is a discussion if the Amida of Arvit is Chovah, an obligation, or the Amida of Arvit is Rishut, which means optional. Now, why on one level should Arvit be different than Shachrit? So let me give you first the technical explanation, and then we'll look at some symbolic explanations. The technical explanation is that Chazal saw the prayer service as making up for the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash and the absence of Korbanos. So at least one view sees Tfilot correspond to making up the Korbanos, even though Tfilah existed before Korbanos as well, but at least after the Korban Beis HaMikdash, Tfilos take the role of Korbanos, and this is based on a verse in the prophet Hosea, a very famous verse, Unishalma Parim Sifatenu, we will pay back the Parim, the bulls that we cannot bring with our lips, with our tfilos. Now we know that in the Beis HaMikdash, there was a Korban Tamid of the morning, and that is why we pray Shachris, and there was a Korban Tamid in the afternoon, which is why we pray Mincha. There, in fact, was no korban that was brought at night. At night, there were no regularly scheduled korbanos, but any leftover fats or limbs from the korban tamids that were not consumed would be consumed throughout the night. If there was nothing left to be consumed, they were not. So consequently, it is clear that shachrit and mincha are obligations because they correspond to the sacrificial cycle. But since Arvit did not have a regular korban, it was only because of hekter chalavim v'yemurim, the burning of leftover fats and limbs, so perhaps it would be an optional prayer. What is the counter-argument? The counter-argument is there's another origin for prayer, and that other origin of the prayers corresponds to the patriarchs, that Avraham was misaking the prayer of Shachris, Yitzchak was misaking the prayer of Mincha, Yaakov was misaking the prayer of Arvit. So basically, one might say, this is what the Pnei Yeshua says, actually I'm assuming a certain commentary that's not explicit in the Gemara. Let me point out the following, just to be sure you understand here. The Gemara discusses whether Arvit is Rishut or Arvit is Chova. And the Gemara discusses different views, but it nowhere tells you the reason for those different views. So what I'm telling you now is a commentary, not the Gemara itself. And the commentary I'm offering is that of the Pnei Yoshua, one of the great commentators on the Gemara, where the Pnei Yoshua wants to say that the debate, if Arvit is Rishut or Chovah, is connected to another debate, which the Talmud never connects explicitly, whether the cycle of Tfilot are because of the patriarchs, the Avos, or the cycle of Tfilos are because of the Korbanos. You understand what the Pnei Yoshua is doing? The Pnei Yoshua is linking two debates that are not linked in the Talmudic text, but the Pnei Yeshua says they depend on each other. That's a very important technique, so to speak, that commentaries use, that sometimes the Talmud does not connect debate A with debate B, but in fact the commentaries will show us a connection. Now, one other point of clarification. The debate whether the prayer of Arvit is Rishut or Chovah has no application to the Shema. Don't confuse the Shmona Esrei with the Shema. The recitation of the Shema at night is absolutely an obligation in the Torah. B'shachbacha uvakumecha. At the time that you go to sleep at night, you say the Shema, uvakumecha, and when you get up. So we are not discussing Kriya Shema. We are discussing the Amida. And there we're going to have a debate, Chova or Rishus. Now, second point I want to make is, please do not walk away from here saying, oh, you know, there's an opinion that says you don't have to daven Maariv, so I'll just skip Maariv tonight, because all of the poskim say that even if in its inception it was Rishus, but because for hundreds and hundreds of years it has been accepted, it has now become an obligation, simply because a minhag that the Jewish people accept in itself becomes an obligation. I will say, though, that the idea of Rishut still has a resonance for women in the following way. I'm not going to go into the halachas of how much davening a woman has to do, but suffice it to say that the stricter view, and I'm not saying, you know, whether any given woman has to follow this, you should talk to her Rav or Posek. But the stricter view, which is commonly taught in Beis Yaakov's, is that a woman does have to daven Shachris and Mincha. Now the question is, why don't you hear about a woman davening Maariv? I believe, I don't have a daughter, that even the very religious Beis Yaakov's don't tell women they have to daven Maariv. The answer is exactly this. Even for a man, Maariv was in its inception a Rishus, and not a chovah, and it became a chovah only because of minhag, and since women did not accept that minhag, they are left with the original idea of rishus. So the one area where the idea of Maariv being a rishus still applies is why even in a Beis Yaakov shita, that's very, very strict about shachris and mincha, generally speaking, women are not told to daven arvit. Although I have to say, the Aruch HaShulchan actually said, who's very mekel normally, actually says women should daven arvit as well. But again, as I say, I'm not issuing any psak halacha on this difficult issue. I mean, as I'm sure all of you know from your own experience, although women are obligated to daven, there are opinions in halacha that their davening does not require a fixed Shmona Esrei, but they could be yotzei with a prayer in their own words and the like. So there are many, many different views regarding women's tefillah. But okay. But be it as it may, therefore, this is our debate. The debate is, are tefillat arvit rishut or tefillat arvit chovah? So we start off with a Talmud Echad. A certain Talmud approaches Rabbi Yehoshua, one of the great Tanoim. Omar Leh, he says to Rabbi Yehoshua, Rebbe, my teacher, Tfilat Arvis Rishus O Chovah. Is it a Rishus, optional, or is it Chovah? Omar Lo, Rabbi Yehoshua says to the Talmud, Rishus. Don't worry about it, it's Rishus. Now, the Talmud's name is not given in this Brisa, interestingly enough, but at the very end of the story, it's not clear why there was such an interest initially to cover up his identity. He is given, we are told who he is, the very end of the story, and that is, he is none other than the celebrated Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, or Shimon Bar Yochai, the one who is buried in Meron, the one in which half a million people go to visit on Lag Ba'Omer, although I'm told that Meron is so crowded that even Rav Shimon Bar Yochai goes away for that weekend and the like. And we know that Rav Shimon Bar Yochai is the author, or at least, well, again, that gets us into a whole scholarly debate, but at least he is the attributed author of the Zohar, HaKadosh, the cornerstone of Jewish mysticism that he revealed to his disciples on the day of his death, which is said to be, again, everything is uncertain, said to be Lag Ba'Omer. And I'm going to explain, based on Rav Cook, why it's so interesting that he was the one who posed the question. Okay, it's very significant that he posed the question, and we'll see why. But let's first see a little bit of the story. So he asks Rabbi Yehoshua, who was his teacher, Rishut or Chova? So Rabbi Yehoshua said, Rishus. Bo lifnei Rabban Gamliel. He then, this Talmud, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, goes to Rabban Gamliel. Now Rabban Gamliel is not just another rabbi. Rabban Gamliel happens to be the Nasi, the head of the Sanhedrin. And he asks Rabban Gamliel, Rishus o Chova? Amar Lei, Rabban Gamliel says, Chova, of course. So Amar Lei, now this is a no-no, please do not emulate Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai in this way. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai then says to Rabban Gamliel, huh? How come you're telling me Chova? I heard from another rabbi, it's Rishus. Yes, so first of all, this whole thing is very, very strange. Why is Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai asking once he has an answer? And it's not even a question of a practical halacha, because what's the difference? I mean, if he's told, Rishus or Chova, if he wants to do it, he can do it. Apparently, he was not satisfied with Rishus. He was looking to make it an obligation. But for him, that made no difference. If it's a Rishus, he could do it. And if it's a Chova, he must do it. So if he wants to do it, nothing is stopping him. We'll come back. We'll come back. Again, I just want to cover a little bit of the story so you'll get a sense of the narrative. So he's shopping around. Of course, let me point out, in contradistinction to when we shop around, which is usually to get an easier opinion, he's shopping around to get a stricter opinion. He doesn't like the lenient opinion that says Rishus. He's looking for a stricter opinion. But, and again, we'll talk about why he's doing that. But in addition, he shouldn't try to get the first rabbi in trouble. He says, you're telling me Chova, but he told me Rishus. So you're going to see that if Rabbi Gamliel would have just been another rabbi, then, well, he argues with me, and that's fine. But because he was the head of the Sanhedrin, he saw Rabbi Yehoshua's attitude as undermining his authority. Now, it's a bit difficult to understand this unless Rabbi Gamliel, unless Rabban Gamliel had previously issued this as a ruling, but if it's simply Rabbi Yehoshua didn't know, what's going to be the problem? But let's see what happened. So at this point, Rabban Gamliel says the following. When he hears that Rabbi Yehoshua disagreed, Amar Lei, Amar Lo, because it's in Hebrew, Hamtein, wait around a little bit, Ad sheyichnesu balei trisin, Lebeis HaMedrash. Until the shield bearers enter the Beis HaMedrash. Now again, let me just explain. Rabbi Gamliel was what was called a Nasi. But a Nasi actually had three distinct overlapping positions in the Jewish people. The Nasi was the political leader of the Jewish community in terms of negotiating. Of course, at this time, remember that this is after the Churban. Just remember the time over here. There are two Rabban Gamliels. There is Rabban Gamliel HaZakein, who lived in the last decades of the second Beis HaMikdash, and he had a son, Rabban Shimon Gamliel, and then there was a grandson, Rabban Gamliel of Yavne. So you need to have a little bit of historical perspective here. This is in Yavne. This is not Yerushalayim anymore. This is in Yavne. This is after the Churban Beis HaMikdash. The Jewish people have been demoralized. The Jewish people have been broken. They have been destroyed. They have lost the Beis HaMikdash. The Sanhedrin and the Torah leadership are trying to build up the people both politically but more important spiritually. And you're going to see that it's Rabban Gamliel's view that in order to build up a fractured, debilitated, demoralized people, we need to have strong, centralized leadership as opposed to different people doing their own thing. In times of national calamity, there needs to be an achdus. That's what we're going to see, that his attitude was, he was very intolerant of dissent, not because, as Rav Kook points out, because of arrogance or gaiva, and we'll see proofs for that, but because he felt, particularly in this time of destruction, we need to hold people together and create achdus and the like. So, as I say, a nasi had three functions. He was the political leader. He was the go-between between the Jewish community and the oppressive Roman government, whose regional capital was in Caesarea. The Roman capital in Israel was not Jerusalem, it was Caesarea. That was role number one. Role number two is the Nasi was head of the Sanhedrin, which was a judicial body, actually a combination of a legislature and a judicial body. He was the head of the Sanhedrin. But number three, the Nasi was also the head of the yeshiva that had many, many Talmidim who would come and learn and the like. So here, we are not dealing with a Sanhedrin session. We are dealing with a yeshiva session. And the term for people who rigorously fight the battles of Torah are called the shield bearers. Balei Terisin. This is an expression that we still might use. And again, Rav Kook points out, this has an interesting double imagery. Why are budding yeshiva students, so to speak, called Balei Terisin? On one hand, it certainly conveys the image of war. And indeed, how do we describe Talmudic learning? Milchamta shel Torah, the war of Torah. If you ever walk into a Beis HaMidrash, a spirited Beis HaMidrash, Mir or whatever, or Sameach as well, you know, you will hear yelling and screaming. And I remember from my days, the people I think are calmer today than they used to, because I remember as a yeshiva student, people would bang tables and say, "No, idiot!" No, you know, they would not scream at each other and the like. There are stories about Gedolim walking by and hearing an argument they didn't think was right. They would jump through the windows, break the glass sometimes, you know, and get so involved. And the Talmud actually describes that when a father and son are learning, it looks like they hate each other. But at the end, they walk away with love because they're all trying to learn the same Torah. So on one hand, the image of shield bearers connotes soldiers who are fighting a war. But Rav Kook points out, it's very, very interesting, that a shield is a defensive weapon. It is not an offensive weapon. It could have said, you know, sword bearers, etc. So Rav Kook points out that this shows you something, that when we learn and we argue and we have different viewpoints, we're not out to demolish or destroy the other person's viewpoint. We're trying to defend ours because we come to a certain truth and therefore we want to uphold it. But Torah is not about destroying the other person's viewpoint. It's about rigorously defending yours and let him defend his, and then, you know, we decide which makes more sense. So Rav Kook says there is an imagery of war here, but the war is more of a defensive war as opposed to a war of aggression and a war of trying to delegitimate the other side. Okay, but be it as it may, Rav Gamliel says, let's wait until the scholars come to the Beis HaMedrash. So now listen. Kivin shenichnesu balei terisin lebeis HaMedrash. When the Talmudic shield bearers came into the Beis HaMedrash, Amar HaShoel, so the questioner, in other words, Rav Gamliel instructed Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai to resubmit the question to the whole group. We have all of our yeshiva here. Ask your question to the group. So, the same question. Arvis o chova. And Rabban Gamliel once again opined chova. So then Rabban Gamliel said to the sages that were there. Now again, we're assuming from the context, these are not young students. These are advanced Talmudic scholars. So Rabban Gamliel says, chova. Then he asks the crowd, anybody disagree? So nobody disagrees. Rabbi Yeshua himself, who is the senior rabbi, says, nope, you say chova, fine with me. So Rabbi Gamliel then says, you're telling me chova? But it was reported in your name that you said rishus. Are you denying what you said? So he then said to Rabbi Yeshua, and look at this again. A lot of this conduct is difficult to understand. He said, Yehoshua. He didn't call him Rebbe Yehoshua. He said, Yehoshua, stand up. and let the witnesses testify against you. Like it was a criminal trial. And Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai testified, Rabbi Yoshua told me, Rishus. What do you say to this? So Rabbi Yoshua says the following. If I would be alive and the witness against me would be dead, in other words, he had said when before he died, and now he's not alive anymore, so I could say he's mistaken. But now I have a live witness against me. How can I deny it? So, Rabbi Yeshua says, you're right. I said, Rishus. I admit. So Rabbi Gamliel told Rabbi Yeshua, stand up. It's almost like he punished a child. Stand in the corner. Rabbi Gamliel was teaching. Everybody was sitting. Rabbi Yeshua had to remain standing for the duration of the session because he had the chutzpah of arguing with Rabbi Gamliel, and he had the chutzpah of denying that he had done so by essentially saying chova.
Wasn't Rabbi Gamliel too...
So we'll see. Yeah. So, well, you'll see. You'll see what happened here. Again, I want to do some of the story, then I will go back. Now remember, Rabbi Yoshua is actually the second, I mean, he's really the second most important rabbi there. I mean, Rabbi Yoshua is not just anybody anyway. He's very, very senior, very, very chashuv, very, very esteemed. That is why Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai went to him in the first place. So, people are getting very, very uncomfortable. People are sitting, and they're listening to Rabbi Gamliel, and they saw a great gadol, humiliated, embarrassed, standing up like a child. And of course, it's interesting to Rabbi Yeshua's credit. He assumed, in other words, he didn't just say, who are you to tell me this? He was makabel Rabbi Gamliel's order. But the Talmidim cannot stand this anymore. They see this as humiliation. They see this as dictatorship. They see this as high-handedness. And they instruct Rav Chutzpitz, the Mator Gaman, to stop talking. Now again, you have to understand a little bit. There is a position that existed in the time of Chazal called the Mator Gaman. And the Mator Gaman literally means the interpreter. And the way this works is the Mator Gaman essentially was like an ancient public address system, a human public address system in which the teacher of Torah would just say his teachings in a lower voice, and the Meturgeman would blast it out. And he wasn't supposed to add his own interpretations. In fact, the Gemara gives a story that there was once a great rabbi who was teaching, and the Meturgeman was giving his own interpretations. So the rabbi's wife, who was sitting next to the rabbi, knows that the rabbi said one thing and the Meturgeman said something else. So she said to her husband, how are you letting this guy say his own stuff? I mean, he was adding his own stuff. So the rabbi in his humility said, all right, so they'll learn from me and learn from him. That's not so bad. It wasn't false, it was just not what he was saying, etc. He says, so this was the great humility. Kriyas HaTorah also had a Mator Gaman, that had a different role. In the time of Chazal, the Baal Koreh would read a verse, and the Mator Gaman would then translate and explain in Aramaic, which was the popular language. So in effect, that's right, Haimanim still have it, among other everyone else. That's been abolished simply because Aramaic wouldn't help us very much, and to do it in the vernacular was not authorized by Chazal per se, so we don't do it, and the like. So the Mator Gaman here is actually somebody who's also very well known from other sources, Rav Chutzpis, the Mator Gaman. Now the reason you may have heard the name is that in the elegy of the 10 martyrs that were murdered by the Romans, one of them is Rav Chutzpitz HaMetor Gaman. He is actually mentioned in this story in passing. And obviously he was a very, very righteous man as well as a great Torah scholar. In a way, you have to feel sorry a little bit for the Mator Gaman because the Mator Gamanim were great Torah scholars. But generally speaking, except for that one exception, their job was not to convey their own. They were just mouthpieces for other people. So I can imagine there was a certain frustration in that type of position. But if you're doing it l'shem shemayim, it's the Torah Hashem, so you know, you do your job in that way. By the way, people should know that although, you know, we read about the elegy of the 10 martyrs both on Tisha B'Av and on Yom Kippur, the lists are a little different, although they overlap. You get the impression that 10 people were killed at the same time. In point of fact, this was over a 100-year period. I mean, poetically, we took them and made one single story of them, but they were not killed at all the same time. Some of the martyrs were before the Churban Beis HaMikdash, and some of the martyrs were well after, such as Reb Chutzpitz and Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva was all the way in Bar Kokhba revolt. Rabbi Akiva was killed over 70 years after the Churban. So, that's another example of Agada not being taken literally, because we mold it as if it's a single story, when in fact it happened over 110 years. Okay, be it as it may, therefore, the people are getting very, very restless that Rabbi Yoshua is being treated so disrespectfully, and they finally tell Rav Chutzpitz, shut off the microphone, so to speak. Stop communicating Rabban Gamliel's shiur, and Rav Chutzpitz complies with that. And Omru, they then say, how many times is Rabban Gamliel going to treat Rabbi Yoshua with such disrespect? Because this is actually the third event, the third time something that this, like this happened. The first time involved a Rosh Hashanah, it's a famous mission I'll talk about, and the second time involved a Bechor. So let me just give you the background. This is actually a Mishnah in Rosh Hashanah, in which there was a debate between Rabban Gamliel and Rabbi Yoshua about the date of Rosh Hashanah. Again, in this time, even after the temple, the Sanhedrin continued to sanctify the new moon, not based on a fixed calendar. The fixed calendar dates from around the 4th century, the 300s. Now, the temple was destroyed in the year 70. So for more than 200 years, almost 300 years, the Sanhedrin continued to be Mekadesh, the new moon, based on witnesses. Right? The fixed calendar came only in anticipation of the Romans abolishing the Sanhedrin as a body, in which case they could no longer meet, so then they calculated a fixed calendar. This was Hillel II. This was a great-great-great-grandson of Hillel I, and he, together with other people, made the Jewish calendar. But in this time, even though it's after the Churban, Rosh Chodesh was not based on a calendar. It was based on witnesses coming and testifying that they saw the new moon. And then we would send messengers to communicate when Rosh Chodesh was, and that would be very relevant for the holidays. That is why Rosh Hashanah has to be 2 days. Rosh Hashanah is the only holiday which is the first day of the month. So even in Israel, the only people who knew when Rosh Hashanah was exactly were the people in the city of the Sanhedrin, whether it was Yavne or Yerushalayim. Even Tel Aviv wouldn't know. So as a result, throughout Israel, you needed to have 2 days. As opposed to every other Yom Tov, the assumption would be the 15th of the month, Pesach, Sukkot. By the time that Yom Tov came, the Shluchim did inform every place in Eretz Israel. It was only the Gola that didn't know. So that is why the 2 days of Yom Tov in the Diaspora, but not 2 days in Eretz Yisrael, but Rosh Hashanah was 2 days. The only question you might ask is, okay, I understand why most of Eretz Yisrael needs 2 days, but why would Yerushalayim need 2 days? In Yerushalayim, they generally did know, but not always, you see, because sometimes the Sanhedrin wasn't in Yerushalayim. For example, at this time, it was in Yavne. So basically, when the Chachamim said you got to keep 2 days, because that was the original minhag, there were times, even in Yerushalayim, that 2 days had to be kept. Okay, although I have to tell you that there are actually some Rishonim, the Baal HaMaor, who was a very, very independent Rishon, actually claimed that Rosh Hashanah only has to be 1 day in Eretz Yisrael, and he says that the French Balei HaTosfos, who made Aliyah in the 1200s, they just brought their Chutz La'aretz Minhag with them, and in fact, he said even Rosh Hashanah would be 1 day, but that's a Das Yachid that we don't paskin like in any way. So what happened was the following. What happened was that witnesses had testified they had seen the new moon. but the next night it was not visible. So Rabbi Yoshua said, those witnesses must be Eidei Sheker, and he gives a bit of a racy example. He says, imagine witnesses who say a pregnant woman gave birth, and the next day she looks just as full as she did before. It must be she didn't give birth. So we're analogizing the new moon as giving birth. Now you see a little bit of a crescent. So according to Rabbi Yoshua, the day that Rabban Gamliel and the seven proclaimed to be Rosh Hashanah was not Rosh Hashanah. Rosh Hashanah would have to be later. Now obviously, when you throw off Rosh Hashanah, you're not only throwing off Rosh Hashanah, you're throwing off Yom Kippur and Sukkot and everything else. So Rabban Gamliel ordered Rabbi Yoshua, famous Mishnah. So according to Rabbi Yoshua, Yom Kippur would be a day later because Rosh Hashanah was a day later. So he ordered Rabbi Yoshua, on the day that you think is Yom Kippur, that's a day later, I want you to come to me with your money and with your cane, carrying money on Yom Kippur to show that you accept the Sanhedrin's determination that Yom Kippur was the wrong day, but that becomes the day. And Rabbi Yeshua didn't know what to do. So Rabbi Yeshua talked to Rabbi Akiva. Rabbi Akiva said, listen, whatever the Sanhedrin does with respect to the calendar is final. Even if they're wrong, that's the day God sanctifies. If they said, this is Rosh Hashanah, therefore that day is Yom Kippur, even if you are convinced that the witnesses are false, it is valid. They are right even if they're wrong. Meaning, Hashem is maskim to them, even if they're wrong. Lahavdil, it's very reminiscent for those of you that have legal background. Justice Robert Jackson, who was a very famous justice on the American Supreme Court, once said about the Supreme Court that the Supreme Court is not final because it is infallible, but it is infallible because it's final. By that we mean, intrinsically, maybe they're wrong. But if the Torah gave them the authority, then it becomes right, even if it's wrong. And Rabbi Yoshua went to Rabban Gamliel on the day that was Yom Kippur, according to Rabbi Yoshua, which was the day after Yom Kippur, based on Rabban Gamliel. And Rabban Gamliel kissed him and hugged him. And he said, Rebbe v'talmidi, you are my teacher, you are my disciple. You are my teacher because you are greater than me. But you are my disciple because you humbly accepted my words. So at that time, people didn't make a big deal about this. But now that Rabbi Gamliel is embarrassing Rabbi Yeshua, they're saying, you know, remember the story of Rosh Hashanah, where our rabbi, Rabbi Yeshua, was embarrassed and he had to desecrate his Yom Kippur. And then they had another story. And what about the story of a Bechor? So here, again, you need a little background because the Gemara here doesn't tell you the story. Rashi refers you to a Gemara in Bechoros. Now, what is the din? The din is that, you know, we think about a Bechor as Pidyon HaBen. You have a firstborn, a male son. You got to give five shkalim to a Kohen. And that we do today. But there's a whole other aspect of Bechor that's very important. And that is, if you have an animal, a female animal, a cow, a goat, and it gives birth to a firstborn male animal, that animal is a korban. It's given to the Kohen, and it must be brought as a korban in the Beis HaMikdash, and only if it gets a blemish, like a cut or a bruise or a broken leg, can it then, it still has to be given to a Kohen, but the Kohen can then shecht it and eat it. Now, this law applies even today, and this is a tremendous dilemma. Theoretically, if I have a Bechor, I'm a farmer, and I have a Bechor, that Bechor has Kedusha. What do I do with it today? You're really stuck. And I'll talk about how we get around it. You're stuck. You have a Korban, and you have no way of bringing it. Now, because it's a Korban, you cannot shear its wool. You cannot work with it. You cannot, if it's a cow or a goat, you cannot milk it. You can't do anything with it. It's kadosh. You can't ride it. You know, you can't do any work with it. It's a korban. Now, when it gets a mum, you can then give it to a kohen. You still give it to a kohen. You shecht it. and it can be eaten as meat, but until, and you're not allowed to make a mum deliberately. So you would think, well, gee, we have Jewish farmers, you know, what do they do today? So there is a loophole that, although originally it was a loophole that was not encouraged, today it's bedafka encouraged. And that is, the halacha is that if a Jew and a non-Jew are partners in the animal, the animal that's born has no kedusha. So a religious Jewish farmer will sell a tiny bit of the animal, the earlobe, the bottom of the earlobe, to a non-Jew. So the non-Jew owns it, but he's not, you know, there's nothing for him to take. And consequently, if a Jew owns 99.999% of the animal, and a non-Jew owns 0.00001% of the animal that's born does not have the holiness of a Bechor, and it's Chulin. So if any of you are in the livestock business, please be aware. This is a very important formality. The Rabbanut will assist you with this. This is a very important formality that must be obeyed, or there can be very, very serious consequences. Because that Bechor animal, you know, it's a korban. You can't do anything with it. Okay. Now, in the time of the Beis HaMikdash, we might discourage this because you're looking for an evasion not to bring a korban. But today, since we're not allowed to bring a korban, it is absolutely proper to do this. In fact, I'm aware of a family in Baltimore. This is by even in Chutzlars. I'm aware of a family in Baltimore who owned a petting zoo. They owned a petting farm. And they became Balei Tshuva. And they had never heard of this thing about a Bechor. They actually wound up with a sheep that had the Kedusha of a Bechor. And it was a lot of problems, exactly. All right. It was the wrong time to become frum, so to speak. What was the story? They tell the story. They tell a joke about a person that became a Meshuvit. He was a Yid, and he became a Meshuvit. He said, I don't want to keep mitzvahs anymore, etc. But he did tshuva right before Pesach. So his wife says, you know, couldn't you just wait a week, you know, right after Pesach? You have to do it right before Pesach. You want to do tshuva. Right, so the same thing. So they became Balei Tshuva when they had this Bechor, you know. There was a difficult time to become Balei, but I guess that means that the tshuva was extra sincere. Okay, now, why am I giving you this introduction? Because here's the story. The rule is that a Bechor is a korban, right, unless it has a blemish. Once it has a blemish, then it can be shechted, given to a kohen, and shechted as meat. Now, the halacha is the blemish must occur by accident. If the blemish is intentionally made, you cannot eat that bechor, because it was a sin, you intentionally blemished. So because of this, the Mishnah lays down the following rule. If I'm a Yisrael, and I'm in possession of a bechor, and I can show that it's blemished, we believe me that it was an accident, because I have no benefit in intentionally blemishing it, because it goes to a kohen anyway. So I don't have to have witnesses that it was an accident. But if a kohen brings an animal to Beis Din and shows that there's a blemish, we do not trust the kohen, because the kohen has an ulterior motive that he might deliberately blemish the animal, because then he gets to eat it. So as a result, a kohen cannot just show the blemish. A kohen has to have witnesses that there was an accident. Right? This is a Mishnah. That a kohen who owns a bechor is only allowed to eat it if he proves that the blemish was an accident. But a Yisrael who brings a bechor to the Beis Din, he has to give it to a kohen. They will matir the bechor to be shechted even without proof of accident. Because the Israel has no reason to intentionally blemish, even though you might think, well, maybe, what if the Israel has a grandson that's a kohen, right? Because he could have a daughter. Okay, the Gemara discusses the possibilities. But as a general rule, we don't assume you're going to sin to benefit somebody else, right? The psychology of the halacha is, you sin if you get something out of it, but you don't sin to benefit somebody else. Okay? All right. Now, Rabbi Tzadok, and Rabbi Tzadok is also famous. Rabbi Tzadok was a kohen, and Rabbi Tzadok had a bechor that was born, and the bechor got blemished, and Rabbi Tzadok wanted to have the Beis Din permit him to shecht it. Now this is after the Churban. And the question becomes, Rabbi Tzadok says, well, maybe the rule that we suspect kohanim of doing a sin only applies to a non-Talmud Chacham, But maybe a Talmud Chacham has a chazaka that he is reliable. Meaning, Reb Tzadok wasn't Bedavka claiming special treatment for himself. He was just saying, does this rule, he was asking a question, and he was willing to accept it. Does the rule that I'm not believed apply even to a Talmud Chacham? Perhaps the Mishnah only applies to someone who is not a Talmud Chacham. Now, a little word about Reb Tzadok here, because it's important to mention Reb Tzadok. You might, this is another Agada, you might recall, you know, on Tisha B'Av we don't learn Torah, but we do study about the Churban, and one of the great passages, maybe we'll even adapt it as a passage, is in Maseches Gittin, that talks about the story of the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And it mentions a rabbi, Rabbi Tzadok, who fasted 40 years. Now obviously he ate something at night, we don't mean, but he fasted for 40 years. Only a little bit of nutrition at night, that Hashem should be mevatel the Churban Beis HaMikdash. And Chazal say, had there been one other tzaddik like Reb Tzadok, that would have saved him. In other words, this was such a zechus, such a tzaddik, that, you know, he almost did it, he needed one other person, and that would have done it. And at the end, when Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, who engaged in a very controversial, Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai, you recall, was smuggled out of Jerusalem. And he was negotiating with Aspasianus Vespasian, who was at that time the general who became emperor and succeeded by Titus. And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai only asked for three things. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai said, spare Yavne as a place where the Chachamim could go. Spare the family of Rabban Gamliel, this Rabban Gamliel, who was very young at the time. That's why Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was the acting Nasi, but Rav Gamliel now is the Nasi. And the third, provide medical treatment for Rav Tzadok, who was so emaciated. Now the big controversy is he didn't ask to spare the Beis HaMikdash. And many of the sages were very, very critical of him. The emperor was willing to give you a request. The emperor said, ask for what you want and I'll give it to you. And Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai had a cheshbon. If I ask for too much, I'll get nothing at all. Again, this was a... So, it's very interesting that Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was an enormously great person. He was the one who really kept Am Yisrael alive during this tekufa. And yet, there was a great deal of criticism. In fact, some historians even suggest that although he seemed to have been the Nasi at the time, why is Rabban Gamliel the Nasi now? Some suggest that Yochanan ben Zakkai kind of went into retirement as a result of this whole issue. No, we don't know. The simple meaning is, I think historically the opposite is the case. Because the Nasius is a hereditary line of Hillel. And Rabban Gamliel is a great-great-grandchild of Hillel. Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was a disciple of Hillel, but not in the Yichus. I think historically what's going on is that Rabban Gamliel was very young. His father, Rabban Shimon Gamliel, was killed, one of the 10 martyrs. So Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai was like the regent. Like, you know, when you have these little kids that are kings, right? So there's a regent. So I think Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai never intended to be the Nasi. He was acting Nasi until Rabban Gamliel would be older. So this Rav Tzadok is not a nobody. This Rav Tzadok is an enormously righteous person. And he asked the Shaila. So Rav Yoshua said, for a Talmud Chacham, the rule doesn't apply. Rabban Gamliel said, it does apply. And he made Rabbi Yoshua stand up again. So now, the students are saying, we're a little fed up here. With Rosh Hashanah, he made him travel on Yom Kippur. With the incident of the Bechor of Rav Tzadok, he makes him stand up like he's a child. And now, because of Arvis Rishus Ochova, same thing. We are going to replace him. We are going to impeach him. We are going to remove him from office. And this is really an unparalleled situation where, I mean, Rabbi Gamliel was Rabbi Gamliel. First of all, this was the hereditary office going all the way back from Hillel. Although it's so fascinating that in many ways, and we're going to have to leave this for next week, in many ways, Rabbi Gamliel is quite different than Hillel. Why was Hillel made the Nasi? Hillel was so beloved because of his kindness, his tolerance, his mercy, his forgiveness. We have so many stories about Hillel. You remember the famous story that they people made a bet, I'll bet you 400 gold pieces I can get Hillel angry. And it was Erev Shabbos and Hillel is washing his hair. And the person keeps on knocking at the door and asking idiotic questions. You know, why do this group have big feet and this group have slanted eyes? You know, and Hillel gives an answer, then he goes back washing his hair. 2 minutes later, or half an hour later, and Hillel keeps on saying, whatever questions you ask, I'm happy to answer. And then he says, at the end, the person says, are you Hillel that's the Nasi? He says, well, that's who I am. He says, I hope there's nobody else like you. He says, why? He says, you cost me 400 gold pieces. And Hillel says, better that you should lose 400 pieces than I should lose my temper. He says, so in many, many ways, it is fascinating that Hillel was so esteemed that the whole Nasius, which lasted until the fourth century, were all the sons, you know, the descendants of Hillel. Rabbi Gamliel was a descendant of Hillel, direct descendant of Hillel. Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, as I indicated, was only a provisional Nasi till Rabbi Gamliel was older. So yet, it's quite interesting that although this is the Shalshelis of Hillel, Rabbi Gamliel developed a very, very different leadership style. And we're going to talk about this. Rav Kook talks a lot about this, that the debate here is about what is the appropriate leadership of Am Yisrael. And again, he makes the point, and textually this is supported, this is not just an apologetic, that Rabbi Gamliel was not acting out of his own egotism, he was not acting out of his own pride. Rabbi Gamliel felt that a certain autocratic centralization of authority was absolutely necessary to rebuild the Jewish nation after the cataclysm of the Chorban. And the Talmidim, which are really senior Talmidei Chachamim, take the position that decentralization is still very, very important. So we'll discuss this next week. Have a good day.
We're not sure. It probably is. Okay.